Hi, Flocking Amazing listeners, it's Sarah here. You might notice something a little bit different about the sound in today's episode, and that is because today's guest and I recorded in person in the school's music room. So you're gonna hear all sorts of school background noise as well as that loud school air conditioner on. So if you notice something different, it's not just you. We used a different recording for today's episode. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to Flocking Amazing, the podcast all about deep and joyful learning from the team at Bird Brain Technologies. I'm your host, Sarah Fitzhenry, robot fairy godmother and all-around education enthusiast. Bird Brain is known for its groundbreaking technology for students, but this podcast is all about the grown-ups that guide and inspire them. And today I'm going to use the term grown-up loosely because this is one of my favorite people that has like the best childlike mindset in a way that makes them such a fantastic teacher. So I am here with an artist, a technology teacher, a maker. This person has taught all over the world and currently works with grades K through 8 teaching technology, but not just technology, all sorts of different things. I'll let him tell the story at the Peabody School. And yes, I am biased because this is a co-teacher, a co-question asker, and a dear friend of mine. I am here with Chris Haskey. Thanks so much for being here, Chris.
You're making me sound like irresponsible. Like who is this like not grown up she's talking to?
I'm delighted to chat with you and to share your really unique perspective on technology with our listeners. I think they're going to love it. So I always start with the same question so that the people who listen can get to know you. Chris, tell us, who are you and what is your teaching story?
Yes, I'm a technology teacher now, but I didn't know what I wanted when I graduated undergrad. So I kind of tried out teaching and I went to Korea to do that. And I was like, hey, I kind of like this. I like hanging out with kids. And it was such a creative challenge for me. So every day I'm like, okay, how am I going to approach these students? And there's such a wonderful give and take. And one of the things that I learned in that first year of teaching was like, sometimes I was like butting up against the students. It was like we want to be going the same direction. Like, how do I get it so that we're going the same direction? Like, I want to be working with them, not against them. And so like that, and so then just the process of observing and reflecting and making little changes. And through that process, like kind of learning, like having the kids teach me how to teach them, like what are your needs, and really trying to be sensitive to that. And so it's like, oh yeah, I really like this process, this back and forth and this relationship building. And so I have continued to teach in a variety of different settings, and I went down the route of teaching art, because that has been my background, has been something that I've been interested in. And just recently I've switched over to teaching technology, which is, I guess, slightly different than art. I don't know. It depends on that depends on your point of view. So my goals are the same, really, is that I want to help students be more fluent with making and thinking in a kind of non like spoken written language way. Like, can we be thinking in a different kind of visual language or spatial language or kind of computer language? Or there's a variety of different languages that we can be thinking, communicating, feeling, living through. And I'm excited about exploring those languages with students.
That's such a, you'd say that like it's such a basic thing that art and technology feel the same, but that's not something I've ever heard anybody say before. And so I want to come back to that. But first, you talked about how you studied in undergrad and then kind of stumbled into teaching. So did you not study education?
No. I had a studio, art studio undergrad. And then for grad school, I did art education. But that was, I don't know, 6-7 years later.
I'm listening to you describe your first year of teaching and being open to letting the kids teach you how they need to be taught versus my first year of teaching, where I had come straight out of a bachelor's degree in music education, and nowhere in that experience did anyone say, listen to the children, or they will show you, or give the kids a say in what you learn. And so I walked in being like, okay, I am the boss. I hold all of the information. These kids need to sit and they are vessels that need to be filled. Not because that's the way I naturally feel, but because that's what was, I was taught that that's what a professional educator does. And so I picture your first year of education. It sounds so much more fun than my first year. I'm a little jealous.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I think there's something in me that has a really hard time telling other people what is right. Mm-hmm. Right? Like that just seems fundamentally disrespectful to you as an individual, whether you're 5 years old or 25 or 125. Me telling you this is the right way to do things, I'm right, you're wrong, seems fundamentally disrespectful to your personhood, right? Your agency as an individual in this world, your ability to look at the world, assess for yourself. What I want to do as a teacher is I want to raise those things up. Like, I want your personhood to be bigger and stronger, your agency to be better informed, more thoughtfully, like, engaged in the world. So, yeah, so I put learning encounters in front of kids that help build those muscles of, like, how do I make choices for myself? How do I assess this situation? How do I grow myself and develop my own ability to work in this world that's complicated and messy?
So how did your love for technology kind of start, and how did that become something that you taught? Because I think you speak like an artist, and I love that. And you were a beloved art teacher in this school for quite a while. And so how did that transition start?
I've always been interested in computers. My dad is a computer engineer, and he actually never went to college and grew up with the industry and learned from the process of just being with as the computer industry developed. And I think he definitely brought some of that engineering elements home. But I think that also just like lives in me. I see in my other family members like this interested in engineering and the making. And I think there's a lot of that kind of technical elements in my art making. Mm-hmm. Even the things that aren't like technical, like in drawing, there's a lot of technical elements in drawing, and I those things I enjoy. I mean, I enjoy the other elements of art making as well. I think the engineering, programming, electronics elements are, they're just more tools, and they're cool tools. Mm-hmm. I like them, you know, and I am dazzled by them. So it was like, well, why not incorporate those things into my artwork?
And so what made you decide to go from an art class with technology infused into a technology class kind of with art infused?
I think, I mean, like the goal for the technology class is just like ever so slightly different. And mm-hmm. I think like I wanted to change, like I think mostly that's it. Like it's just like I wanted to push myself and find an area of growth, and this definitely seemed like a space where like I want to learn more about programming, I want to learn more about engineering. How can I do that? Well, I can do that on the job, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an exciting place to be, and I can be learning with the kids. And I think I've learned a lot by being like, why am I here? What am I supposed to be teaching to these guys? And that kind of introspective like questioning of what my role is, like, because as an art teacher, I'm like, oh, I know what art is, right? Like I've spent, you know, before even coming into the classroom as an art teacher, I've already spent 5 years thinking about art making. Whereas like now I'm like, oh, I'm in the classroom and I'm thinking about like, what am I supposed to be teaching in terms of like programming or computer mm-hmm. science to these kids? And what's really important for a kindergartner to know or a fourth grader to know that's going to support them in being successful, as a grown up or as a fifth grader, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and what kinds of things can I set up for them? And so really kind of digging down to the fundamental foundational levels of like what's important as a teacher of this subject matter. And I think it's the same things that's important about every subject matter, right? Mm-hmm. And how can we build those foundations?
Yeah. Chris and I teach together twice a week. We teach two creative robotics courses, one using the Finch robot and one using the Hummingbird robotics kit. And so our classes together focus on creative robotics. And by the time we started teaching together, you had already had experience with robotics. I don't know if you'd had quite as creative out-of-the-box experiences as the bird brain tools tend to bring. But what first attracted you to robotics, and what made you, when I came to you and said, hi, will you teach a robotics course with me? What kind of made you say yes?
I think the thing that, maybe a better answer to your earlier question is the same answer to this one, okay. Is it sounded challenging. and how lovely, right? Like, I'd seen robotic stuff before, and I was like, hey, that looks cool. I want to be part of that. And this seemed like an opportunity to be a part of that. And I think kids have that a lot, where they're like, oh, that looks cool. Like, oh, look at that robot thing over there. Or, oh, mm-hmm. like, I don't know, look at that cool musical instrument. I bet you that would be cool. But there's like an intimidation factor. Like, oh, yeah. But I can't do that. Or like, oh, that's for other people. I guess I want to push into that and explode that for myself. And through the process of doing that, hopefully kind of decompose it to understand, like, how can I do that, help others not be afraid of mm-hmm. that? Because that was definitely part of me, like, in high school. It's like, oh, no, I can't do that kind of thing. And even in college. And so, yeah, why? That's silly. That's my own roadblock. How do I find what that roadblock was so that I can help young people get rid of that?
How did you make the transition from I'm too afraid, I don't want to touch that, to why? I can do that. There has to have been a change point, a catalyst in there somewhere. I'm asking because I would like to find that, because I definitely feel that scariness and that imposter syndrome and all of that.
So I've got an answer to you. If I lose track, bring me back.
Okay.
The other day, I was playing this game called Zumbinis. It's a logical thinking game with my third graders. And I was noticing some of them were really enjoying it, and some were, like, kind of stressed out about it. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out, like, what was happening here. And so I was talking to them about it. I was like, what? Like, why are some people enjoying this? Why are some people stressed out about it? And I think what it came down to is some of the kids said, I know I can do this. I know I'm going to be able to solve this problem. I just don't know how to do it yet. And so the process of figuring it out is fun because I know the outcome is going to be success. Mm-hmm. And the kids that were stressed out weren't as, let's use the word confident. Mm-hmm. They didn't know whether or not they were going to be successful. And so they thought, oh, I probably will fail, or I might not be successful. So the process of getting to the final, to being successful, was uncertain, and so it was stressful for them because it was like, oh, I might fail here. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. So I believe everybody in this room, all you third graders, I think you will be able to do this. It is doable. You can do it. So I have confidence in you. So let's have fun and do it together, right? So I think this kind of speaks to your question of like, oh, I see cool people doing robotic stuff. Like, I want to be one of those cool people. do I believe that I can be successful with that? And why do I not believe I can be successful with that? And I think that has been a huge growth area for me as a grown up, as an adult, mm-hmm. is that developing confidence. Like, I wish that I believed that I could do things when I was in high school, in mm-hmm. junior high. Or middle school, as they call it, I can do that. That's what I want to be in everybody's heart. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't in mine. So how do I force people to do that? To believe in themselves, to be like, oh yeah, I can do that. And that it's accessible for everybody. And I think that the way to do that is for me to believe it. As a leader in the space, as like the teacher, if I believe that you can do it, and if I just have this unending belief in you, I think that rubs off.
Oh, yeah. As a co-teacher, it does. And so as students, I can only imagine. So that change in you was so powerful that it shaped the way you make and teach, and it absolutely shows in your teaching. It shows in this conversation right now, and as someone who has watched you teach and who's been in the room when those moments happen, it absolutely translates through to your students. And I've never heard anybody say it so succinctly of like, well, I know I'm going to be successful, so I might as well enjoy getting there. And so it's just a mindset shift of, instead of, can I do this? Yeah. Of course I can do this. How am I going to choose to?
Right.
And how much time am I going to give myself to make mistakes along the way?
Yeah, it's like a, it doesn't make it less hard work,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and it still can be arduous. And I don't decide to do everything that I can do either. Right. And so that actually is like one of the biggest challenges for me at this point in my life is like, okay, I can do pretty much anything I want. Right. Like I'm in a very privileged position to be able to say that. So what do I do? And that, I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, I'm doing this. I'm teaching technology right now. But how do you help somebody make that mindset shift? And I think, I mean, like, I am lucky to be in a school that is sending that message of, we believe you can do this, to the kids in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
And I think most families, I'm not going to say all, but most families are also saying that to their kids. And I know that that's not a message that schools are often saying, and that family culture is not always there with that as well. And so I think that could be a powerful shift that we could do in education. We could be like, hey, I believe in you. You can be successful at this. I hate it when I hear about like weed out classes, like in college, where it's like, hey, the basic premise of that class is we don't think you can do it.
What's the look to your left, look to your right. Only one of you will be here when the semester ends. You know, the stereotypical kind of who can we get to quit? Let's make it as hard as possible.
Yeah, that's what I like. I don't understand, like, why like if you could have more people and a greater variety of voices like at the table, like why wouldn't you? I don't know. And if you could help support those people getting there, how fantastic.
Do you have any advice for teachers who are looking to shift that mindset, who have maybe been trained like me to be the vessel fillers and the experts and to stand at the front of the room and building confidence in students and making them successful adults did not appear anywhere in my degree. It's something I have stumbled into because of incredible educators I've met along the way. I am pointing to Chris with my hand right now. You can't see that because you're listening. But for educators that want to make that mindset shift from, I will give you the information, to, I believe that you can find this and you can do this and you have what you need. How can they get there?
Playing? I think maybe, I don't know what the right answer is here, but I think play is an important part of the stew. Because I think there's a lot of confidence building that can happen there and knowledge creation. But I think also what we're teaching, what I would like to be teaching kids is how to learn. Mm-hmm. What are the ingredients? How can you teach yourself? If you want to learn something, how do you bring that to yourself? And because whatever I teach them now, whatever like morsel of knowledge I shove into their brains, that's going to be useless and obsolete in 3.5 years. even though there's use and concepts and stuff come back and are interwoven within each other, still that specific use of that specific bit of knowledge is not as useful. So in what ways can I have them be more aware of their thinking? They're more aware of their kind of learning process. And I think play is a great way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And a reflective play, right? And because learning is fun, right? Learning is a beautiful thing. And,
yeah.
And when you're doing it, it feels good. And it's joyous and it's like a celebration, right? Like I did this, I accomplished something. And I think education can be that way. And I try to bring that into my classroom.
So teachers maybe need to put less pressure on themselves and allow themselves to play.
Well, I am also in a unique position where I don't have like SOLs to like cover, standardized tests. I'm also in the unique position where I don't have standardized tests where I have to like cover specific material to like meet some sort of standard. Because I'm in an independent school and I have a lot of autonomy over what I teach.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a lot in there as a result. I think the kids get more out of the more open-ended, playful program that we bring than a shove it all in there as much as possible mm-hmm. approach.
It's hard because you want the answer to be find time to play. And sometimes, well, that's what I said. So that's what I wanted the answer to be. And it's so frustrating to think that that is not always an option. Sometimes you have to so carefully carve out time and take it from something else. And when you, having taught in a public school, when everything is so structured and you only have this little bit of time, you want the kids to play, but you also want them to play towards something. And you're kind of panicked that they're not going to get there in time.
Right. Well, okay, so I should define what I mean by play.
Oh, yeah.
And I probably mean like four or five things. So, mm-hmm. And it might look different for kindergarten than it looks for sixth grade, right? Mm-hmm. So, play as like imaginative play, like, oh, we're going to the moon today and let's play with some like dolls to kind of demonstrate those kinds of thinking. I think that's incredibly important and fun, but also a way to explore new ideas that you wouldn't necessarily get to do in other situations. So I want to try to make time for that. Although that kind of play changes and looks different in first grade than it does in sixth or seventh grade, right? Mm-hmm. So so there's that. I think there's also, you know, like playing in a sandbox, right? This is like, I'm exploring with materials and there's no specific end in sight. Mm-hmm. So that's not imaginative play. I'm not on the moon necessarily. I'm still playing in the sandbox, the either literal sandbox or a kind of metaphorical sandbox. And I'm exploring with these materials and I just want to, like, I'm just present for this moment right now. How are these materials working and what can I get out of them? There's no end. There's not like, I need to build this thing right now. I'm just exploring. That's play. Mm-hmm. I think being silly and making jokes is also mm-hmm. a form of play, right? Like, and there's definitely like verbal repartee that happens, especially with the older students. And that kind of playful spirit, I want to be in the space. There's a couple other types of play that I've been thinking about. Well, like, like gameplay, right? So, like, so when there's something there's a very specific end in sight. We have, like, Sarah, you and I do a game playing thing with our robot competition, last robot standing or BattleBot kind of thing, where they're it's like a soccer, but with robots. Mm-hmm. That's definitely play.
Yeah.
And it's a competitive play that really motivates kids in a powerful way. So play exhibits itself in a variety of ways. And I try to demonstrate, I try to like model that for the kids too. And I'm making things or I'm being playful or I show them the experiments that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're silly. Mm-hmm. And I like that.
Yeah. We should all try a little harder to hold on to that silliness, I think.
Yeah.
There's no need for that to disappear when you grow up. Do you ever find pressure from other adults to call it exploration or a genius hour? Or there are definitely different terms for the type of play that you've described, and I find some educators moving away from the word play because they find that administrators, parents, other stakeholders maybe don't take that word as seriously. Have you felt any pressure to call it anything other than play?
I mean, I use a variety of terms, I think, mm-hmm. like when I'm talking to families, to students specifically. I mean, most of my time I spent talking to students. Mm-hmm. But I try to use the same language I talk to students that I use with administrators, that I use with parents as well. Mm-hmm. Kids have the ability to understand like specific terminology. And so if I use that, then they'll start to get it. I mean, I go back and forth because like, because play is such a wide term that it's not necessarily useful all the time. Sometimes mm-hmm. it is more useful to use a more specific term. But that there is this umbrella of playfulness that mm-hmm. I want to kind of keep and hold on to, and that these things kind of fall within that. And yeah, but it is useful sometimes to call it something else. I don't have strong feelings about whether like it should be called this or that.
I really appreciate the way you validate the word play. Our class is with fifth and sixth graders who are maybe feeling some pressure to do a little less play and to be a little more serious as they move. Not that play is not serious, but that's kind of what the air that they bring with them is.
Yeah.
I'm moving out of elementary school, I'm moving into middle school, I'm academic, I'm serious, there's peer pressure, so play is for little kids. And when I'm here, I'm an adult now that I'm a fifth grader and I am no longer. And then they walk into your space and into our class, and it's kind of like, no, play is real. Play is worthy of your time. Play is where you learn. This is you validate play and allow them to see that grown-ups, professional grown-ups, people with jobs, we play too. And that's important, and you should hold on to that. And if you want to call it tinkering, or you want to call it making, or you want to call it exploring, that's okay. But it's play, because play is important, and everyone needs to play. I really like that.
It was a couple years ago, I had this conversation with the third graders of, like, what's the difference between work and play? And I was like, immediately, I was like, oh, they're so different. Like, oh, and then I was like, all right, well, let's explore this. And by the end, people were like, yeah, I don't understand what the difference is. they're the same thing. Like, the more we tried to, like, separate them out, like, mm-hmm. like, define the term, like, well, work is this and play is this, and, well, oh, but that could be play too, and, like, that's not mutually exclusive to work, and, like, they're like, yeah, they're the same.
I wonder how many teachers listening right now are currently nodding vigorously or shaking their heads, like, who is this guy who thinks that work and play are the same thing? Well, I'd be fascinated to know. Please, if you're listening and you have a strong opinion, please respond to this. We want to know. Contact on social media. I want to hear. Do you think work and play are the same thing?
Yeah. I mean, because I only live in my own brain, right? Like,
yeah.
That separation between art and engineering, or art mm-hmm. and, yeah, the technology, right?
Yeah.
It's hard for me to see that dividing line. Whereas, yeah, like, work and play. I mean, some things are unpleasant, and I'm like, man, that's work. And some things are fun. I'm like, yeah, that's play. But, play can also be drudgery too, right? Like, oh. I mean, I don't know. Professional athletes, their job is to play a sport.
But, oh, interesting.
Oh, my goodness. Like, is it play all of the time? And the answer is, well, yeah, that's their job, is to play.
Yeah.
But it's a hard work too, right? So, like, are those terms just on opposite ends of the spectrum, or are they, is it a Venn diagram, or is it just like, well, they're just different things?
This is my favorite question, and I'm really interested to hear how you answer it. Chris, what makes you a flocking amazing educator?
I am shrinking with, like, oh no, look at me, I'm uncomfortable at, like,
every educator I've ever talked to has had that response, so that's not just you. We struggle. So take your time.
Right, because my job is to serve, right? Like, mm-hmm. I want my kids to be successful. Like, me being successful is when my students are successful. When they're like, yes! Like that's when I'm like, yes! And, you know, like, doing the jumping high five crane kick in the classroom. and then saying, don't do that because, like, that's probably dangerous.
Because you'll hit someone.
That's the focus, is like, you gained something, like, you found success today. Like, that's the most exciting thing for me as a teacher. So I think that relates to maybe the earlier in our conversation where we were talking about, like, noticing student need. And I think that's, like, one of the fundamental elements of successful teaching, mm-hmm. is identifying student need and then problem solving. How do I meet that need?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I push that student to go along the path that they want to go along to? How do I help them figure out which direction they want to go in on their path? Empathy,
mm-hmm.
observing needs, celebrating successes, and introspection.
Yeah. I love the way you summarized that. So anyone who's listening can take notes. Man, that's a great answer. And I'm going to be thinking about this conversation for quite some time, about play and definitions and meeting needs and all of these things. Chris, thank you so much for being here and for talking to me about education and play and technology and where all of the things come together. You can follow Chris on Twitter, and I will make sure to link his Twitter here so that you can connect with him. I know he's looking to expand his professional network. He's new to Twitter, so we can give him a warm welcome. Chris, thanks so much for talking to me.
Sure. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate it.
Listeners, thank you for joining us for Flocking Amazing, the podcast for quick, bite-sized conversations with real teachers sharing their real expertise and providing real inspiration to us all. We'll have a new teacher conversation dropping soon, so don't flocking miss it.